National Weather Service on this Wednesday, 15th of August. Cloudy and seasonal, 50-50 chance of some rain, a high of 82. Right now, humidity 91%. It's a cloudy sky. Wind is calm, 74 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. Coming up now on 10 Minutes After 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. Support for WGTD also comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackanddrea.com. And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm excited to be able to spend the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show with Dr. Walter E. Williams, who has been the John M. Olin Distinguished Professor of Economics since 1980 at George Mason University, the author of over 150 scholarly essays and articles, the author of 10 books, including The State Against Blacks, Up from the Projects, an Autobiography, and American Contempt for Liberty. He is a syndicated columnist whose writing appears in approximately 140 newspapers, and he has spoken forcefully on a number of different issues, and I am excited to have this opportunity to talk with him about some of his concerns related not only to our economy, but to the notions of personal liberty and such. Professor Williams, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, good morning to you, and thanks for inviting me.
Well, I have been exploring quite a few of your past columns, many dozens of them as well. One of the most interesting themes that appears time and time again is your really serious concern about the state of affairs on American college campuses. And when we look at your past columns on the topic, again and again, the headline will be something about college lunacy or college insanity. I mean, you use very forceful language to describe what you see as a really serious problem in the kind of academic and social climate of our college campuses. Tell our listeners what is at the heart of this this concern that you have.
Well, I think I think one of the very, very important things that has emerged over the years is the level of contempt that young Americans, particularly young Americans who attend college, as well as their professors, a contempt for the First Amendment, that is freedom of speech, and a number of surveys say that over 50% of college students think that the First Amendment does not cover hate speech, however it does, they think that they have a right to shout down speakers with whom they would disagree, and according to this Brookings poll that I mentioned in my most recent column called "The College is a Force for Evil." They say about 20% of the students think that it's acceptable to use violence to prevent a speaker from who has views that they disagree with. And then another aspect of the whole college thing is that it's my opinion about close to 50% of students do not belong in college in the first place. And how I come up with such a number is that roughly it's between 40 and 50% of all incoming freshmen require remedial English, remedial math, and remedial reading. And so that suggests that they're not college ready, that they have fraudulent high school diplomas. When I say fraudulent high school diplomas, I mean that a high school diploma attests that a kid can read and write at the 12th grade and compute at the 12th grade. And very often the kids can read, write, and compute at the 9th or 10th grade, and still they receive high school diplomas. And then I guess a whole lot of things that happen on college is this general hate for America. And I give many, many examples of professors long before President Trump became president, expressing ideas to his students about Americans and conservatives. This one, just as one example, in the recent column I wrote, that a English professor at Montclair University in New Jersey, he said, conservatism champions racism. There's another economics professor at UCLA said, the United States of America, backed by facts, is the greediest and most selfish country in the world. And you find many, many statements and videos if you go to a website called College Reform or College Fix, you'll find ample evidence where students have videotaped the professors making these remarks.
One thing I want to ask you, however, is when we think about the inaugural address that newly elected President Donald Trump delivered, it was probably, in terms of its tone, one of the most negative, certainly in recent memory. In terms of calling into question all kinds of, you know, what he saw as troubling realities in our country. I mean, how does that square with your concern that raising such concerns is somehow displaying hatred towards America?
Well, I think I don't remember all of the president's inaugural address, but I think that from what I see, that the president has not shown any reluctance in calling things as he sees them, whether he's right or wrong, but he has not shown any reluctance, and he's not politically polished like other presidents, and so there's very little room for misunderstanding of what he said, whether you agree with it or disagree with it.
Right.
But I think that we need to say things for a recent example, no other president would have said it, but he's talking about the fires in California, and he is pointing out that the fires in California have a lot to do with the extremist environmental movement that don't allow the cutting of down of trees, thinning out of forests, the forest, and allowing a lot of dead brush that's easily kindling for a fire, or diverting water to take care of some kind of a endangered species, and not allowing people to dig fire breaks because they're concerned about the habitat of maybe the kangaroo rat or something like this. And I doubt whether any president in recent memory would have said the same thing.
Right. No, I don't think anybody on the left or right will contest the characterization of President Trump as a very frank communicator. My only question is when he raises such concerns and speaks on such unflinching terms, it isn't necessarily displaying some sort of hatred of America. That's all I'm pushing back on, the notion that when we raise troubling concerns about America's present or past, that doesn't necessarily mean we hate America or are demonstrating hatred about America.
By no means. And I think that we all are duty-bound to be truthful in our response and then talk about the good things and also the things that need to be changed in our country.
We're speaking with Dr. Walter E. Williams, who is a member of the faculty of George Mason University. He has been there since 1980. Professor Williams, you speak very forcefully when it comes to matters of race, and in particular to the troubles experienced by some of the African-American population here in America. I think one of the most striking columns you have written on the topic was one in which you point out the extraordinary accomplishments of African-Americans, of blacks in America as a group. I think you write, as a group, black Americans have made the greatest gains, overcome despite the highest hurdles and in a very short span of time, of any racial group in mankind's history. And of course, what you're setting up there is then a conversation about the struggles of those in the black community that are not part of that stunning success story. And you lay most of the blame actually at blacks themselves and in some of the choices they're making and so on. Talk more about that and what can be done about that.
Well, when I said that black Americans have made the greatest gains over some of the highest hurdles in shortest period of time, I asked the listener to look at the fact that black Americans, if you just add up the amount of income that we earn and thought of black Americans as an independent nation, we would be, our GDP would put us around the 18th or 19th richest nation on the face of Earth. There have been some black Americans who are among some of the world's richest people. It was a black American, Colin Powell, who headed the world's mightiest military as chief of staff. One black American became president. And black Americans are some of the world's most famous personalities. Now, the significance of all this is that in 1865, neither a slave nor a slave owner would have believed that these gains could be possible in just a little bit over a century. And as such, it speaks to the intestinal fortitude of a people who are able to accomplish these gains. But just as importantly, it speaks of the greatness of a nation in which these gains were possible, and that is the kind of gains that black Americans made would have been impossible anywhere on the face of Earth except United States of America. That's why I say it speaks very well of a nation that in which these gains are possible. Now, the big problem that confronts us is how can these gains be expanded to 35% of black community for whom they appear to be elusive. And I think that at the beginning to address this problem is to recognize, excuse me, that the civil rights struggle is over and it is won. That is, at one time, black Americans did not have the same constitutional guarantees of everybody else. Today, we do. Now, just because the civil rights struggle is over and won, that does not mean that they're not major problems. But the point is that they're not civil rights problems. And if you just look at the big problems that confront many, many black people, one is the illegitimacy rate, which is 75%, and whites it's over, slightly over 30%. This is a devastating problem. That is, if you look at prison inmates, a large majority are from female-headed households. High school dropouts and other kinds of antisocial behavior are people from female-headed households. Now, the significance of this is that in 1938, the illegitimacy rate among blacks was only 11%, and that among whites was 3%. And so we cannot, a lot of people will blame the high rate of illegitimacy and they lack in female-headed household, they'll blame it, they'll call it a legacy of slavery. Well, that's just plain nonsense. That is, more blacks grew up with two biological parents during slavery than today. In 1925, in New York City, 85% of black kids were in two-parent families. And we can cite statistics like this to demonstrate that it's not a legacy of slavery. And just one other point. Another major problem that black Americans face is just the education system that confronts blacks. It turns out that the average black high school graduate, he has the reading, writing, and computational abilities of a white 6th or 7th grader. That is, black kids are going through high school, going through rotten schools, and not being educated very well at all. And then another issue is the very high crime rate in the black community, where people are huddled in the homes, afraid to go out in the street, and it's not the Klan that they're concerned about. It's other black people that are preying upon them. So these are some of the problems, and they have very, very little to do with slavery or racial discrimination.
So in other words, you would call us not to shift the ultimate responsibility away from where it really belongs.
No, that is absolutely right. That is, if just looking at the issue of illegitimacy, that is, a girl having deciding 15, particularly 15, 16-year-old teenager, young woman, deciding to have kids without the benefit of marriage, that doesn't have anything racial discrimination. It's irresponsible behavior. And nobody can do anything about to change that. Washington can't do anything. Democrats can't do anything to stop it. And the only people that can stop it are black people themselves. That is, to have higher moral standards. You know, when I was a kid, I was born in 1936, and which makes me 82 years old. And when I was a kid, growing up in a housing project in North Philadelphia, it was, if a girl made a mistake to have to get pregnant, she was an embarrassment to her family. Very often, she is sent down south, or out of the city, to live with relatives. Today, young people have out of wedlock babies, and they have baby showers. Then there's no embarrassment whatsoever. And so, this is many things that we observe among blacks today is entirely new in black history.
While we're talking about this, although this is not exactly in the headlines at the moment, you've written extensively on the intriguing question of Confederate monuments and whether or not the removal of such monuments amounts to an attempt to rewrite or whitewash our history. And you seem to believe very, very strongly that, in fact, those monuments need to stay in place because they are a part of our history.
Oh, yeah. I believe that we can't rewrite history. And matter of fact, one of the tragic things about the Civil War, I like to call it the War of 1861, is that the victors of war, they write the history of it. And there is and the history is probably very, very incorrect. That is, and that's why I don't call it Civil War. That is, a Civil War suggests that there are two or three parties trying to take over the central government. And Jefferson Davis, who was the president of the Confederacy, he no more wanted to take over Washington, D.C., than George Washington in 1776 wanted to take over London. That is, it was a war of independence. That is, the South who wanted to secede. And what a lot of people don't realize is that the Constitution would have never been ratified if the states, it's in 1787, if the states did not believe that they have the right to secede. And if you look at the ratification documents of New York, Virginia, and Rhode Island, they explicitly say in the document that if the government becomes abusive of the powers that we've delegated to it, we have the right to secede. And so that's in fact what they did. And by the way, and just as a note on this, is that the Treaty of Paris in 1783 that ended the war between the colonies and Great Britain, it declared, you can look at the first or second couple paragraphs in on the Treaty of Paris, it declared that there are 13 sovereign independent nations, and these 13 sovereign independent nations came together as principals and made the federal government their agent. And we know from standard law that principals have the right to fire agents. And these statues, They're of brave men who are fighting for their country. And another thing that people don't realize is that many blacks in the South, they fought on the side of the Confederacy. And so a lot of people say, well, gee, why? Well, they weren't fighting for slavery. One of the points that most people, most Americans today don't know, is that for most of our history, up until maybe the early 1900s, Americans did not consider themselves citizens of the United States. They were saw themselves as citizens of New York, or citizens of Georgia, citizens of Pennsylvania. And so these blacks and other people saw their country under attack, and they offered to help defend their country in the hopes that they'd be treated better after the war.
In other words, it's your contention that these southern states had every right to secede.
Oh, that's absolutely right. And and if you read some of Madison's words, the so-called the acknowledged father of the United States Constitution, during the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia, one of the delegates brought up the question of should we have in the Constitution that states cannot secede, and Madison rejected it, saying that if we did something like this, states, he was afraid that states would view it as act of war.
One question about the Confederate monuments. It came to my attention after interviewing a longtime resident of Charlottesville, Virginia, where of course, some of those dramatic demonstrations occurred, that Charlottesville, Virginia had, I believe, 5 city parks. 4 of them were for whites only, and only one of them was for blacks only. And the statue of that was under such contention was located in one of those parks that once upon a time was whites only. So if we're in the business of preserving history and not reshaping it, surely you wouldn't take it that far as to say that we should have segregated city parks. I mean, some of our history is meant to be discarded.
It's meant to be discarded, and it's a historical fact that and tearing down statues cannot change the historical facts. I mean, that is, you know, if you look at many signers of the Constitution, they were slave owners. So do you want to say, well, gee, we can ignore the words of Jefferson, we can ignore the words of George Mason and Ulysses Grant and all these because they were slavery? You know, what a lot of they were slave owners. What a lot of people don't realize is that slavery has been a part of mankind's history. That is the first slave. As a matter of fact, blacks were the last to become enslaved. And if you look at the word slavery, slave, it comes from the Slavic. That is, the Slavic people were amongst the first slaves, and that's how the term slave came about. And so, what is unique about the United States and Britain and France is that they made great efforts to end slavery. They made the greatest efforts in mankind's history to put an end to the evil institution. And today there's slavery that goes on in the Middle East and in Chad and some other countries in Africa today.
In our closing minutes, because time is going getting away from us, I want to be able to hear from you on something that is also a very frequent theme of many of your columns, and namely it is what you call in one column legalized theft. That is when government takes money out of my pocket or your pocket and spends it on somebody else. And that would be, so for much of the federal budget, a majority of it for things like Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security, food assistance, unemployment, and so on, you characterize that as legalized theft.
Well, my initial premise that I make when I look at any problem is that we each own ourselves. That is, I am the property of Walter Williams, and you are the property of Greg. You belong to yourself. And so the fact of self-ownership, if we accept the idea of self-ownership, well, then there's certain acts that are immoral. That is the reason why murder is immoral. It violates private property. Rape is immoral. It violates private property. Theft is immoral because it violates private property. And when Congress takes the earnings of one American to give to another American who, to whom they do not belong, that is just theft. That, you know, if you look at it, if I see an elderly lady sleeping on a grate in dead of winter in downtown Washington, and I walk up to you, I say, Greg, give me your $200, and then having gotten your $200, I take and I buy this lady some medical attention and some housing and some food. Well, I believe most Americans would say, well, I have committed a crime. I have committed theft. And theft is taking the rightful property of one person and giving it to another to whom it does not belong. Now, is there any conceptual distinction between that act and where the agents of the United States government, namely the IRS, came up to you and said, well, Greg, give me that $200 you made last week, and we'll take it to help this lady out? Well, both of them represents taking the rightful property and giving it to another to whom it does not belong. And in the first case where I walked up to you and took your money under threats, intimidation, and coercion, it would be theft. You know, it would be theft. I would go to jail. Where the second case where the agents of Congress came up and took your money, that's just legalized theft. Both acts involved taking what belongs to one person and giving it to another to whom it does not belong. So, and I think that what it represents the forcible use of one American to serve the purposes of another American, and I think that that's immoral.
So if you had a magic wand and could wave it, would you do away with, for instance, the things I just listed off? Do you believe that those should not exist at all?
Well, I wouldn't want to go cold turkey. I'm addicted to stuff. You want to have some kind of approach, but I would want to recognize that we would want to get back to morality. You know, I believe in helping our fellow man in need, and I believe that reaching into one's own pockets to do so is praiseworthy and laudable. Reaching into somebody else's pockets to help a fellow man in need is worthy of condemnation. And for the Christians among us, when God gave Moses commandment, thou shalt not steal, he did not mean thou shalt not steal unless you got a majority vote in the United States Congress.
So what would happen then to those in our society who, through no fault of their own, are in desperate, dire need?
Well, that people have been desperate, dire needs throughout our entire history, but we didn't have the welfare state through our entire history. People voluntarily help one another. You know, Americans are some of the most generous people on the face of this earth. You know, all the huge charitable foundations, they began in America, and so. There's no evidence anywhere of people in our history of people dying on the streets, like in Bangladesh, because of starvation, or people dying on the streets because they could not get at least a little bit of medical help. Charity has been the engine to help one's fellow man throughout our entire history.
Last quick question, if I may. I know that you have grave concerns about the interest of some in what we think of as diversity and multiculturalism. What is at the heart of your concern about us thinking about inclusiveness and diversity? What is the harm created by that?
Well, I think that one of the things, you know, I've always said to people that the true test of one's commitment to, say, free speech does not come when he allows people to be free to say those things with which he agrees. The true test of one's commitment to freedom of association, to associate with whomever we please, does not come when we permit people to associate in ways that we find acceptable. The true test of freedom of association comes when we allow people to associate in ways that we find utterly despicable. And so to be for personal liberty requires that you be a very brave person, that you're able to tolerate people engaging in those voluntary acts that you find despicable. And that's not the lesson being taught at universities through diversity and inclusion. And then some of it's really despicable. You know, if you ask the average president the question, how many Republicans do you have in your sociology faculty, or your history department, or your English department? And they'd be hard put to say even one Republican. Or if you look at any Saturday afternoon college basketball game, you won't find it does not look like America. You find the absence of Chinese, Japanese, and you might find one or two white guys, but they're mostly blacks. And so, is there diversity in college football, or diversity in college basketball, or is there diversity in Nobel Prizes? It turns out that Jews are 3% of the population, less than 3% of the population, but they pick up 35% of the Nobel Prizes in science awarded to Americans. There's no diversity there at all.
Well, you've raised some intriguing points here, and I'm afraid time necessitates that we leave it there. But we certainly invite people to seek out your columns wherever they are published, and some of the books that you have written as well. Dr. Walter E. Williams is the John M. Olin Distinguished Professor of Economics at George Mason University. Professor Williams, I have enjoyed our conversation. I'm really glad we got to have this conversation. I hope we'll get to speak again.
Okay, and thank you very much for inviting me.
You bet. And my thanks to Dr. Yuri Maltsev, a faculty colleague at Carthage, who suggested this interview. It's 8:41, and you're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. Here's part two out of the archives.
I'm very excited and honored to be speaking for the next few minutes with U.S. Senator Mike Lee, Republican from Utah, who is one of the most powerful voices in the country right now on the topic of the scope of government. And Senator Lee believes strongly, and really has for all of his professional life, that the government ideally is not going to be overly intrusive into our lives, and that a smaller, streamlined, simpler government is a better government. Better for our country and better for each of us as Americans in terms of our daily lives. He has written and spoken extensively on this, and has done so again with a new book which follows up on his previous books, Our Lost Constitution and The Freedom Agenda. His newest book is called Written Out of History, The Forgotten Founders Who Fought Big Government. And in this book, Senator Lee seeks to right a wrong, that is, the expungement from our written record of some of the dissenting voices among the founding fathers who were deeply distrustful of this whole notion of a central federal government, and were really anxious that that new government not have too much power, and that it not wrest too much control and autonomy away from the states, let alone from individual Americans. The book is published by Sentinel. And Senator Mike Lee, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much. It's good to be with you.
I'm glad we can have this conversation. We should explain that the balance of your book focuses on some of these specific founding fathers, and I use the term loosely because, of course, several of them are actually women, but men and women who were part of this first generation of Americans, and I hope we'll have time to touch on the specifics of a couple of these people. First, I want you to expound on something which you say in the introduction to the book, when you talk about how the contentiousness by which our Constitution was put together, particularly in this matter with the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists, that actually that back and forth resulted in a stronger document than otherwise would have been produced. Just say a word about, even though you might take issue with what ultimately ended up in the document, how the controversy and contentiousness of the situation actually produced a much stronger document than would otherwise have been created.
As is the case with any discussion, the discussion at the Constitutional Convention in 1787 sharpened the debate. It highlighted what the important key points were. And it highlighted, among other things, that our founding generation was very skeptical of the fact that a big, distant national government could well come into being as something that could harm them. In other words, they had detached themselves not just from the idea of having a king, but perhaps even more importantly, from the idea of having an all-powerful national government. That national government had been based in London, and that, for that reason, they instinctively put in place a very weak national government right after the Revolution under the Articles of Confederation. It was too weak, as it turned out, but thanks to the discussion, the debate that ensued at the Constitutional Convention, they managed to find a document, to conceive of a document, that balanced these interests of, on the one hand, having a national government that was strong enough to do what only a national government could do, and on the other hand, one whose powers were sufficiently limited as to safeguard the right of the people to local self-rule, which has become something of an American norm upon which we've relied for centuries.
One of the things you say about the this contentiousness and about what we would think of now as dissenting voices whose opinion in some of these matters ultimately didn't really carry the day, is you use words like expunged and erased. And you say some of the most presciently vocal and aggressive of these dissenting voices have been erased from our history. You also say, though, that history is written by the winners, and sometimes we just leave things out. And I'm not sure it's a matter of semantics or not, but it's one thing to just not bother to mention the names of the losers, or those on the losing end of an argument. It's another to say that such names have been really sort of systematically erased. I want you to explain why you are using that kind of really strong terminology here.
Well, because, first of all, it has the same effect, whether it was done deliberately or not. It has the same effect when you neglect to mention certain aspects of our history, especially when you say, as many people do, that the founding generation was led exclusively or almost entirely by people who were white and male. Some were, but some were not. And those who were not did, in fact, break the mold. But we can acknowledge their existence. We acknowledge the existence of Mum Bett, for example, a slave in Massachusetts who fought for and ultimately won her fight for freedom based on her reading of the Massachusetts Constitution established in the early 1780s that identified all people as free and equal under God. People like Mercy Otis Warren, a contemporary and friend of John Adams, who became at times a bitter enemy based on the concerns that she expressed for the new Constitution and for the big national government that she feared it would create.
One of the most common ways to craft a narrative about the writing of our Constitution, and this also steps back to the writing of the Declaration of Independence, for that matter, is this notion of these colonies that needed to come together in order to throw off the yoke of tyranny. Would you concede that the strength of a federal authority in that moment in our history was imperative? I mean, that if individual states had retained the kind of autonomy that some of them really wanted to retain, that we would not have been sufficiently united as a United States of America to, in fact, become an independent nation? Or do you really regret right from the start that there was this coalescing around a strong central federal government? I mean, do you think we could have become independent even without that?
No, I absolutely think it was essential. We could not have survived without a national government that could look out for the common interests of the states, particularly when it comes to national defense. And the system we had under the Articles of Confederation was woefully inadequate. Didn't create any of the powers that really needed to exist centrally. Among other things, it couldn't adequately provide for a national defense or regulate trade between the states. And so I don't think anyone who thinks about these things a lot, at least hardly anyone, looks back at that and thinks otherwise. That's not what I'm saying at all. What I'm saying is in order to understand the Constitution today and understand some of the problems that we have today, we can benefit from looking back at some of those who expressed concerns about what might happen with the federal government and see that some of those concerns have been brought to bear. That doesn't require us to change anything in the Constitution necessarily, but it can cause us to reflect back and to give more life to features of the Constitution that have been neglected, things like federalism and separation of powers.
Right. You spend quite a long time in your book talking about Aaron Burr, and of course that is a name that has become much more prominent to Americans today, for among other reasons, of course, the musical Hamilton. And of course, you seek to give us a much more nuanced portrait of this important early American. I think it would actually be more interesting for us to spend some time with a couple of people whose names will be, I suspect, completely unknown to our listeners. For instance, the interesting guy you talk about in Chapter 2 of your book, Luther Martin. As a Lutheran, I have to be really careful not to flip the names. It's Luther Martin that we're talking about, who, among other things, was, you tell us, a notorious drunk who tended to talk on and on and on, and yet was a very, very important voice, perhaps the single most outspoken of the anti-federalists. Tell us what made him a significant player at this point in our nation's history.
Well, yeah, Luther Martin was, in fact, a notorious drunk. In fact, he became so notorious that even among those who respected him as a lawyer, and many did, he went on to be the longest-serving attorney general in Maryland's history and was a delegate to the Constitutional Convention. But one of his clients actually retained him on the specific condition that he not drink during the pendency of the case. He got around this through a loophole. He took a half a loaf of bread and he soaked it in brandy, and he would eat from that bread from time to time. So technically, he was complying with that, even though he was still ingesting alcohol. But Luther Martin was the original and the most outspoken among the anti-federalists. There was, as you recall, this debate between the Federalists, who favored the Constitution's ratification, and the anti-Federalists, who advocated for non-ratification. Luther Martin, while a delegate to the convention, refused to sign the document because he believed that it would end up creating too strong of a federal presence, too big of a federal government, one in which the local right to state rule, the local autonomy enjoyed by states and local governments, would be lost. And he raised a lot of these arguments, some of which turn out to be somewhat prescient today. But again, the important thing to remember here is that none of this, while resonating with us as it may in some cases, requires us to change anything about the Constitution. None of this means that they were wrong to draft and ratify the Constitution the way they did. But some of the warnings that he presented and some of the ways that those warnings were responded to tells us a lot about how far we've drifted from this central feature of the Constitution, which is this vertical protection within government that we call federalism.
Hmm. One of the points you make in this chapter that I think is especially interesting is the notion that when one argues to not concentrate too much power into a central federal government, that it is not based on the assumption that state government is always better or somehow infallible, or that state government's not going to make all kinds of mistakes or maybe try to put into place laws that are utterly inhumane, but that when there is corruption at the state level, it is so much easier to deal with than corruption that might be deeply rooted in a distant federal government. Am I framing your argument correctly there?
That is exactly right. In fact, I'm not sure I've heard a better description. I sometimes analogize it to a vehicle. It's easier to turn around a smart car than it is a semi-truck. It is easier to turn around a personal watercraft or jet ski than it is an aircraft carrier. It's easier to turn around a state government or a city council run amok than it is the federal government, an entity that spends about $4 trillion a year. And so this is one of the reasons why federalism is so important. And one of the other reasons why it's so important is that it just allows more people to get more of the kind of government they want. There is immense political diversity in this country, and it varies by region from one state to another. More people in America would be able to get more of the kind of government they want and less of the kind of government they don't want if we followed federalism. That's one of the reasons I talk about it so much in Written Out of History. And I've devoted an entire chapter in Written Out of History to Canasatego, who was an Iroquois chief who helped inform Benjamin Franklin about the virtues of what came to exist as modern American federalism. We often think of the founding fathers as elite white males, when in fact some of them were not white, some of them were not male, and some of them were Native Americans, including Canasatego, whose story I tell in this book.
Could we spend just a couple minutes talking about this extraordinarily gifted woman by the name of Mercy Otis Warren? She is a name absolutely brand new to me until I read your book, and although she was part of quite an exceptional family, she was really something very, very special, someone who never took up arms on behalf of the new nation. Instead, in your words, she took up the quill. Tell us the kind of difference that she managed to make.
Okay, so she wrote a number of books. She wrote them as plays that she didn't necessarily know would be performed, but she wanted them to be written. She understood well the fact that government power is necessarily wielded by human beings, and consequently, it carries with it grave risks. She frequently raised these concerns with her friend John Adams, and the two of them carried on this lengthy correspondence that sometimes got very, very heated. She, as she examined the Constitution as it was proposed, said that, among other things, there's too much of a risk that the executive and legislative powers would be so dangerously blended as to give cause for alarm, that the separation of powers as contemplated within the federal system wouldn't serve as an effective check. And what we might end up with would be a sort of monarchy in miniature. And she and John Adams had a lot of heated exchanges about this. They ultimately reconciled their friendship toward the end of their lives. But the two who had been good friends had their friendship severely tested as a result of her inherent suspicion of big government.
Who did you write this book for? Did you write this primarily for those who are on your side of the aisle, who share a similar sort of deep concern about a powerful central government? Or is this instead written for, or maybe also written for, those on the other side of the aisle who do not see this issue as you do, but who might learn something from hearing from some of these forgotten founders?
I wrote this book for both groups of people, for people at every point along the political ideological spectrum, because I've come to believe, after 6 years of service in the Senate, that there are a whole lot of questions that are neither distinctively necessarily Republican or Democratic, liberal or conservative. They're simply American issues. They're constitutional issues. What I learned in writing this book is that a lot of the problems, a lot of the disputes that we face today are not all that new. The specific issues are new. The names of the precise pieces of legislation are new. And some of our disputes involve new technologies that couldn't have even been imagined 230 years ago. And yet the same basic debate rages on today, the debate about the nature of human beings and what they can do through government, the nature of how and to what extent we need to restrain government power. So I wrote this book for all Americans, understanding that a lot of these stories have just been forgotten, but they need to be remembered, because all of us can benefit from the freedom that comes when we recognize limits on government power.
The book, again, is Written Out of History, The Forgotten Founders Who Fought Big Government, published by Sentinel, and the author, Senator Mike Lee. Senator Lee, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about your very interesting book.
Thank you very much.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I'm going to be replaying from the archives an interview I conducted with Dr. Thomas Knorr, Professor Emeritus of History at Carthage College and the author of a book called Soapy, a biography of G. Menin Williams. G. Menin Williams was a wealthy gentleman from Michigan who actually disregarded the predominant political persuasion of most of his family and relatives, and charted a course for himself as a very independent thinker and profoundly unconventional politician. A really fascinating figure, and Professor Knorr's book about him